Hey there, Elizabeth.
Hey, Sheila. So we've been friends for what, nearly 14 years now?
I think about that. Yeah, although we've been really good friends for about half of that, but that's kind of a part of our story, isn't it?
It is. Well, at least for now, we're really good friends in large part because we've learned to be honest with each other. But it's not always perfect. Nevertheless, we're learning a lot by being imperfectly honest and thought you might too.
The Imperfectly Honest podcast is for informational, educational, and entertainment purposes only. This podcast does not provide medical advice and is not intended as a substitute for the diagnosis and treatment provided by a licensed, trained physician, psychotherapist, or other health professional. This podcast expresses the individual opinions of Elizabeth, Sheila, and their guests and does not constitute professional medical or mental health services. In sharing their experiences, names, places, and other identifying information may be changed to protect the privacy of the people involved. Hey there, Elizabeth.
Hey Sheila, how are you?
I'm doing pretty well. Just got back from California last night visiting family, so a little tired, but very energized from the visit, and also really looking forward to this conversation.
Me too. Well, we have a guest today. Our guest is Brad Feld. Hello, Brad.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. It's nice to see you. It's been a while.
It has been.
Brad and I have known each other for over a decade now. He is a prolific venture capital investor and author. And I'm not sure how they gave you this title, but I once saw that you were titled the most powerful venture capitalist in the world. How did they come up with
Well, for starters, it's false.
that?
Most definitely not that. I've never heard that title before, so I have no idea where that came from.
Well, I saw it on the internet, so it must be true.
It was generated by one of the AIs.
And Brad just launched a new book called Give First, The Power of Mentorship. And we're going to talk a little bit about that today. But Brad has been my mentor for over a decade, and you helped me a lot, especially when I was pretty early in my career. And I would always jump at the chance to try to help you. And I said that I was kind of struggling to find ways to help you because you had a bigger network than me and you were further along in your career. And you said something that I will probably never forget, which is, all you really need to do to help me is focus on what you're already focused on because you're doing things that I care about. And I really want to support you because I want you to work on those things that I care about. When I invited you to join us today, I had a totally different topic in mind. And since then, I've had a little bit of a journey with my own mental health. And since that's something that we both care a lot about, and Sheila cares a lot about as well, we thought that would be our best topic for today.
Well, sounds like a good topic. I'm not, I was going to say sounds like fun, but digging into mental health stuff isn't always fun, but it's often very useful and productive.
Well, weirdly, I actually find it fun. I find it fascinating. So, just a little bit of background on my own mental health. So, I have OCD. I have a relatively unhealthy fear of germs, and I've worked a lot on it. So, it doesn't really impact my life in the way that it did when I got to sort of the worst of my OCD. Now I feel like I'm conscious of it, but I'm living my life exactly the way that I want to. And it's something that I'll probably have to work on for the rest of my life. I also am something called hypomanic, which is a very mild form of bipolar. And a lot of artists and CEOs, politicians, actually highly successful people are hypomanic. And the way that I experience it is that I have the ability to get so excited about what I'm working on and to get so inspired that I have trouble sleeping. And when I get into that creative flow, I can get these periods, which I would best describe as creative euphoria with euphoric clarity. It's like all the patterns that I've been trying to put together and think through suddenly become clear to me, which is an amazing gift, but it makes it hard to sleep. So I have been on my own journey to manage those two things and to think about how those might be gifts more than diseases. And each of us on this call has a relation to mental health as well. So Sheila, do you want to share a little bit about your relation?
Yeah, I would appreciate that. I had a very, very close family member who struggled with depression throughout their lives, starting back in the early 80s. And in the early 80s, there really wasn't a whole lot of information out there about mental health, specifically depression, not a lot of resources, not a lot of understanding. And so I kind of took it upon myself to educate myself so that I could educate other family members who were involved. And what that meant in the early 80s was I went to the library, which I loved. I was a voracious reader my whole life, and went to my favorite card catalog place and the Dewey Decimal System, my pal. And that was the start of my kind of learning curve in terms of depression. And so that's one aspect of why I feel like I have some knowledge in this area. The other is professionally, for a few years when I was an assistant county attorney in Albany, New York, I worked as counsel for the Department of Mental Health. So that probably opened up a lot of information for me also. And then just ending this, when I moved to Seattle in 2016, I joined the staff of, it was a transitional housing community for women who were, they came to us, and it was a 2-year period of time that they lived with us. And it was essentially to heal from crises and domestic violence. And a lot of the crises that they had been dealing with revolved around, some of it was substance abuse, but a lot of it was mental health. And so I learned from that. I was the director for an educational program that we had as they kind of got on their feet. And I also oversaw the personal work that the residents did with the social workers that we had on staff. Some of it was their own issues, and some of it was just dealing with the healthcare system, and some of it was dealing with government assistance on those issues. So, fair amount of background, not, as I said, personally, it was the family member, and then professionally, it was just in the jobs that I had.
Well, I'll jump in with my own experiences. Elizabeth, like you, we share OCD as a gift. I was diagnosed in my 20s after having a pretty extreme depressive episode. And it was the 1980s, so nobody had any idea what OCD really was. I got lucky. I had a very, very good psychiatrist who had actually been studying that as one of the things sort of in his universe that he paid attention to. There are people, you know, today I'm about 60 now, so 40 years ago, there are people today, occasionally you'll hear somebody say, OCD is my superpower, or I'm OCD and that's a good thing about this. And I strongly disagree with that. I find OCD to be really, really challenging thing to have to deal with. And while it can be managed, and you know, I feel like today I understand how to manage it pretty effectively after lots of work, you know, there are still moments that are incredibly triggering. And Elizabeth, I'm sure you had the same experience I had at the onset of COVID, which was just abject fear all the time of any interaction with any other human being, which is just, you know, it's hard. In the context of it all, one of the things I have come to believe and come to assert is that, you know, as humans, we're all just big bags of chemicals. So everybody has different challenges when those chemicals don't mix in the same way or in different ways, and sometimes in challenging ways. And so one of the things for me that's been so important, maybe in the last decade, has been trying to destigmatize issues around it by just being open about it and talking about it. Not just, you know, what the issues and challenges are, but, you know, how I've dealt with it and how other people have helped me with it. And also in different ways where I've changed behavior To navigate life so that I'm in a better, happier, more satisfied place more often, especially when I can use some of the, the indicators or triggers or things that are causing me problems, or in my case, creating anxiety or depression as, early warning signs about something that's out of balance somewhere else.
Well, I sometimes feel like it's a gift because
I separate gift from I separate gift from superpower. I don't want somebody to misinterpret what I said. I think let me say it better. The language of gift is the right language. Like, it's just part of who we are.
Right.
And I think the thing that I'm reacting to is not somebody that has OCD saying I'm OCD and therefore it's somebody who doesn't have OCD and doesn't understand how challenging and in some cases insidious the links between the O's and the C's are and how hard it is to navigate that in different circumstances. Everyone has obsessive behavior. Everyone has compulsive behavior. That's not OCD. OCD is the linkage between those and the challenge that that linkage ensues. Tying it back to your comment of a gift, and sorry to cut you off, but I realized after I said it that somebody could interpret me as saying, oh, Elizabeth, I don't agree that it's a gift. I agree. I think it's a gift in the same way anything that makes up our character and our sense of self, our biology, our physiology, whatever, those are the gifts that we start with. And we can view them as liabilities or we can view them as opportunities or gifts. And from my frame of reference, I think it's so much healthier to say, hey, this is a gift. I'm going to use this to be more effective while at the same time defining clearly what I mean by more effective, where more effective has a whole spectrum of things, just not more productive.
Right. That's a great clarification. I'm actually glad that you cut me off. And the best thing that I can share to just sort of underscore that is that I did not really learn to cook growing up. And I'm now learning how to do simple things like how to cook eggs. And I had a friend teach me how to make poached eggs for the first time. And I'm 44 years old now, the other day. And I came up with 47 things that I learned from that process. it was a great story and a lot of fun, insightful things came out of that. And my mind gets tired. I sometimes will ask people, what's on your mind? And they will honestly answer, nothing. I'm just walking or something like that. And I don't even know what that's like. My mind starts working the moment I wake up. And generally, I'm a pretty good sleeper, with the exception of a few nights a year, typically. But my mind gets tired. And sometimes I don't pay attention to other people or things that I need to because my mind is always working. So it's just kind of an ongoing balance and figuring out how to leverage the best and do normal things like drive a car without going off the road, for instance.
Well, I'll pile onto the 47 things. I love that you came up with 47 because 47 is a prime number and I really like prime numbers.
Love it.
And there's another, for anybody that understands OCD, there's another piece of it, right? I love prime numbers. I really love the number 3. So anything related to the number 3 is good. And when I was really struggling before I understood what OCD was, if I didn't do something 3 times, I had to do it 9 times. And if I didn't do it 9 times correctly, I had to do it 27 times. And if you have to do something 27 times in a row correctly, you get it right because you don't want to have to do it 81 times. I say that, with the benefit of looking backwards, like having to lock and unlock my door exactly a certain way 3 times before leaving the apartment could often mean that it took me a while to leave the apartment.
Right.
And to link the O and the C together, what was in my head was I need to unlock and lock my door the right way 3 times before leaving the apartment, or else I'm going to have a bad day, or else I'm going to lose a customer, or else my partner, at the time that I was really struggling with this, my wife will do something problematic, which that wife ended up being ex-wife, and there were problematic things. So, you know, like the foreshadowing, your brain not necessarily making up irrational linkages. Some of them are totally irrational. If I don't, as I'm walking down the street on the way to my office in Boston, if I don't, every cigarette that I see on the sidewalk, if I don't make it parallel to the street, my mother will die. And anybody that's ever walked down the street in downtown Boston, maybe it's better now, but when I was living there in the 80s and 90s, there were plenty of cigarette butts on the street. And, you know, you're spending a lot of time straightening them. Back to germs. I hated germs. I hated dirt. Like, you're not straightening the cigarettes with your hands, you're straightening them with your feet, you know, with your shoes. And I can keep going. Like, there's all these things that just get in the way of normal life. It just consumes a lot of your mental energy. And it's kind of the thing you're describing, you're experiencing, Elizabeth, when you're overwhelmed with, you know, just endless thoughts while you're trying to do something, you know, that theoretically is routine, drive down the road or whatever.
Well, and you're leading me to my first question, which is, what you're sharing is really brave, because people will make assumptions about you based on what you shared. And a lot of people will say, wow, that is so brave that he's sharing that. And then there's people who will say, wow, I've had thoughts like that too. And if somebody like Brad can accomplish what he's accomplished and he has these thoughts, then there's hope for me too. And so there's a lot of power in saying things like that. And I've learned the hard way that it doesn't always go well. People use their own experiences, their own prejudice, all those things to react to the things that you say publicly. And sometimes it can create some drama in your life that may or may not be accretive to what you're trying to accomplish. I'm trying to figure out what part of my story to tell, because the reason why I actually think having a mental illness is fun for me right now, and it kind of ties into the theme of your book, is that the impetus for this podcast, and perfectly honest, was that 4 years ago, I had just kind of a rock bottom health moment. I had a very large tumor that curved my spine that created systemic havoc on my body. I was going through a divorce. I moved to Montana after I had lived in Colorado for my entire adult life. And I was living somewhere where I didn't know a single soul. And it was right off the heels of COVID. It was just a lot of stuff going on. And then I got really sick and my body just kind of shut down. And I ended up in the ER, and I had to wait 6 hours to get blood work at a time that I really needed to eat. And my body completely shut down. And I actually had a mental breakdown in which I was unable to send an email for 3 days after that. And it was a gift, a terrible experience that I would never want anybody to go through in many ways, but it allowed me to see all the ways in which people are discouraged from getting help for mental health. And the three of us really like to make a difference in this world. And so I felt like it was something that was meant to be. And 5 days later, I saw this woman who knows me very well, who said, "Hey, I heard you had a rough week. How are you doing?" And I looked her straight in the eye and said, "This is the best week of my life. I am learning so much. I am feeling really creative. I can see all these ways that I can actually make an impact to fix some of the problems that I've experienced. I've learned all this stuff about my body and the human body and how I can help others, etc." And she thought that I was having a psychotic episode and called some people behind my back because she was worried about me, and she had reasons to be afraid, and she was trying to help. But I was at a point that I really needed to heal, and it created all of this drama in my life that made it harder to heal. And so this is all to say, I'm really thinking about if, when, and how to tell the details of my story to make a difference. And I'm just kind of curious if either of you have some experience or advice to help me figure that out.
I got a couple of thoughts. One, I think that there's a profound starting point that Elizabeth, that you described in that last bit, which is these situations that are really challenging, instead of being oppressed by the challenging situation, you use it as a way to learn about yourself and about other things. It's not it's not a detachment from the challenging situation. You're in the challenging situation. And especially when it's one that's physiological, you know, psychological, whatever, and you're dealing with really hard stuff. But I think it's easy to flip into either a victim mode or a mode where you're just not curious or interested in how these things are happening. And it leads to the second comment I'm going to make, which is getting to the root cause is so different than dealing with whatever the surface issue is. And unfortunately, in our contemporary healthcare system, at least in the Western part of the world, we're so focused on the symptomatic behavior. Doctors are so focused on the symptomatic behavior. Patients are so focused on the, I just want to feel better. Health systems are so focused on, I got to move patients through because I've got a limited amount of dollars for whatever reason, that it is challenging. And as an individual, you have to take the initiative to go deep on your own issues. Now, we have a good structure for how to do that, which is either psychology or psychiatry. Coaching is a business step towards that for people, although I do think coaching is quite different than either working long-term with a psychologist or a psychiatrist. But I simply view them as a collection of going to planet yourself. So, you know, I would describe when somebody would say, why are you doing therapy right now? You seem fine. And I'd say, because I enjoy going to Planet Brad for 50 minutes once a week. I met this guy, his name's McAndrew. His job is to listen to me and guide me and try to guide me to dealing with some of the deeper issues. At one point, I finished therapy. The language for finishing therapy is terrible. It's called terminating. For some reason, that's the language that psychiatrists and psychologists use. But I terminated my second course after 10 years. I did in my 20s. I did it again in my late 40s to late 50s. And I remember very viscerally a moment with McAndrew, who were, you know, 45 minutes, almost finishing up a session. He says, Brad, I just want you to think about this. Actually, he said a code word for us, which was when he was going to challenge me with something that he wanted me to really dwell on. He'd say, can I tell you something? And you know, of course you could tell me something. He said, I want you to really consider whether right now what you're doing is actually digging deep to get at the roots of some stuff, or whether you're just moving a pile of dirt from one place to another. He didn't say to me, you're moving a pile of dirt from one place to another. He told me he wanted me to think hard about it. And I thought hard about it over the next week. And I came back, I said, you know what? I get it. And, you know, obviously you were, without saying it, you were saying it. You're giving me room to say, no, this is fine. I'm happy here. But I said, no, I we need to go deeper. There's some stuff deeper than what we're actually been talking about for the last, whatever it was, 6 months or 12 months. That then generated some profound next level breakthrough. So like I put a container around that as a second thing, which is independent of the external world, this idea, whether it's with a coach, whether it's with a therapist, almost needs to be with someone. I don't believe that people can be very effective at that inquiry by themselves in most situations that have to do with your own physiology or your own psychology. It's possible, but it's really hard. And if the only times you ever do it is in those moments of distress, then are you really building good forward patterns? Are you figuring out things in an effective way? That leads to the place you started, Elizabeth, which was this idea of, you know, how open should I be with the world and what's the implications of it? And let me describe it from my frame of reference. When I was in my 20s and I was depressed, I was terrified. I had enormous shame of any publicity around anything. I was running a company. The company was successful. I had a business partner. I had a marriage that blew up. I then ended up in a new relationship with my now wife, Amy. But I really was ashamed of that I was struggling. I was a CEO. You're supposed to be a strong leader. CEO is supposed to be strong, supposed to be confident. Everything's supposed to, like, you know, ooh, let's go. I then became ashamed that I was doing therapy. I was ashamed that I took medication. I ended up deciding to take medication because one of the challenges with OCD is the only way you can really be effective with cognitive behavioral therapy is to lower the anxiety level, and mine was very high. So until then, the CBT is not terribly effective at addressing OCD. That was something that in the late 80s, early 90s was not well known. Again, fortunately, I was lucky with who I found. At the time, a lot of what you got was you got the medicine without the CBT, or you got the CBT without the medicine, or you got a different kind of therapy because you're misdiagnosed that wasn't actually helpful. I got depressed again. I had another really extreme depressive episode in my 30s that was triggered by 9/11. And it was a function of complete physiological exhaustion from the collapse of the internet bubble. And here, lots of people, especially in the United States, I think struggled for a couple of months for different reasons. But I was again ashamed of being open about what I was really feeling with really anybody other than in that first business. It was Amy and my business partner, Dave. I was open with both of them, but nobody else. The second time, it was really just Amy. I was very closed to the world externally about what I was struggling with. Over time, as I got a little bit older and, you know, I got into the 2007, 8, 9, 10 time period, 2011, I started to be more open about some of my struggles, but not in a really clear-minded way. It was around the edges. And it wasn't until I had a depressive episode in 2013 that I decided to be very public about it. It was on the heels of a couple of well-known entrepreneurs who had committed suicide in the prior year, sort of surprise to everybody, especially with one or two of them. There was also, I was very, very, very close and still am close friends with Jerry Colonna, who had started talking a little bit about his own struggles. And certainly privately, we talked about it a lot at this point. So I wasn't as ashamed of extending that circle to some others. I talked with my foundry partners when I was feeling down. We were pretty emotionally available to each other in lots of different ways. And I was, of course, seeing many, many, many more founders as at the very early stages as a result of all the investments we were making through Techstars. And, you know, all the different behavior that I was seeing from founders, especially ones that, you know, you could clearly see were struggling at different levels with different aspects of, we could say their mental health, we could say their psychology, we could say, you know, their own place and things. So in this moment where suddenly I was having another depressive episode, I was writing all the time. I was very public. I was talking all the time about different things around venture capital entrepreneurship. And I just decided I would be bullshitting myself too much if I wasn't open about and included this element of my life in it. I talked a lot about what, you know, being an entrepreneur felt like, what being an investor felt like, a lot of different issues around it. I was finishing a book with, at the time, I don't remember if it had been published yet, with Amy called Startup Life, in which we talked about some of these issues, but, you know, talked about all kinds of aspects of being in a relationship with an entrepreneur. So I just decided I would be doing something for myself by not talking about it that was actually a negative feedback loop. And it's something I've learned since, which is one of the things that is really harmful when you're struggling with anxiety, depression, anything else, bipolar, a manic incident, borderline personality disorder. If you don't have any self-awareness of it, that's one thing. If you have self-awareness of it, step one is go spend time on planet yourself. Go do some work to try to understand what's going on and develop some tools for addressing it. At some point, when you start to have some comfort with it, being able to talk to people that are your intimates, people that you're close to, in a way that's safe feeling is important. And expanding this concentric circle is useful. I think if you expand it to be a public thing too quickly, you haven't necessarily understood what's happening underneath it. And the flip side of it is, you know, hey, Brad, has anybody ever used it against you, said something hurtful to you, done something that, you know, made you wish you'd never talked about these issues? The answer is, of course. And you know, fortunately, none of them have resulted in cataclysmic events for me, but some of them have been very hurtful and have been difficult. And I think partly for me, the fact that I had a lot of years to work into it and understand what was going on. And really it was from age 47 to age 57. I think anything before I was in my by the way, 47 was about the time I started being public about it. So I started seeing this psychologist, McAndrew, and at the same time I was public about these issues. Prior to that, I hadn't really been. And I think in my mid-30s, if I'd been public about this stuff, I wouldn't have really known how to handle some of the things that came at me. And part of it was because I hadn't really processed and dealt with my own issues. So I don't think it's age. I think it's where you are on your own experience of going inward. Work, and again, I think one has to work with someone. I don't think you can just, I can figure out my own way of dealing with this stuff. I think that's doing yourself a disservice. Until there's some comfort and understanding of it, it's hard for other people to know how to be helpful. And I'll just end with the comment you made about this person's reaction is very important. I expect that person was trying to be helpful. And in exactly. The moment, they were profoundly unhelpful. And I can tell you that's been the case for many of the people I've interacted with over the years. And one of the things I've tried to write and talk about, which is things you can do for someone when they're struggling, the difference between helpful and unhelpful. And for a lot of people, especially people who haven't dealt with their own stuff, that's really hard too, because they haven't dealt with their own issues. And now all of a sudden they're having to interact with somebody else that's struggling. Ugh, you know, that can really be a difficult situation.
Yeah, and I just want to make it very clear that if anyone is ever concerned for my personal safety or concerned that I am going to harm someone else or anything like that, then help. I don't care if you help wrong or right, but try to help. And my best example of a foiled attempt for help that actually went really well is that right after I had my mental breakdown, woman who's very close to me was acting seemingly irrational. I was saying, I'm accepting that I have these mental health challenges and physical health challenges. I'm really motivated to work on them. I'm also motivated to make a difference based on my experience. I'm a sponge of information. I want to be helped. And she kept reflecting in a way that made me think that she didn't believe me. And she kept trying to get me to accept my mental health challenges. And that was very frustrating to me. And it was also insulting because I felt like they were really questioning my judgment and my fortitude. And after about 10 goes around where she kept trying to get me to see the light that I needed to accept help, she finally admitted to me that she was bulimic for 7 years. And she is of a generation before me when people didn't talk about those things and she didn't know how to get help. And she threw up so often that she had calluses on the back of her hands. And she would show them every time that she was at the doctor's office, hoping and praying that someone would see those calluses and get her the help that she needed. And I was so mad at her before she told me that story and I figured out what was happening because I was feeling so insulted. And she gave me the best piece of information she probably could have given me, which is that I am really lucky to have grown up in a generation where accessing help isn't shameful. Understanding her story has illuminated so many things for me. And so, again, you know, I have been physically and mentally very hurt, which is a whole nother podcast, by people's attempts to help me. And I don't regret a single one of them because they were attempts to help me and they were, you know, signs of people's love for me. And I learned something from it every time. But it also makes me fearful because I am a person who is actually not ashamed. I'm pretty comfortable telling my deepest, darkest secrets to cab drivers and random people on chairlifts and things like that. I've just sort of always been that way. But I've learned that when I do that, sometimes people I love actually are ashamed of the information that I'm sharing. And so I had to learn that lesson, which was hurtful. But I am somebody who wants to access help. I have incredible financial resources and a network and a background to be able to access any help that I want to access. And it is still really hard to get the help that I need, which makes me terrified for other people in these situations. And part of my motivation to do this today. And so on that topic, Brad, I know that you've worked on some things and you are working on some things to address mental health philanthropically. And I'm curious what you're most involved with and excited about now and whether there's ways for other people to plug into those things.
Yeah, there's probably a spectrum in terms of how other people can plug in. I think that's probably a little harder to define. I'll give kind of a general answer to it. The spectrum of stuff range from very local activity. For example, in Boulder, we have a health system called Boulder Community Health. It's a community hospital. And we now have a building called the Delicava Center that is one of the few multi-layered mental health facilities that's both outpatient and inpatient, that's both locked and unlocked on the Front Range. And for a community like Boulder, it's pretty unique to have something as significant as the Delicava Center, because in most of the time, if somebody's having a significant episode, they end up in one of two places. They end up in the ER, they end up in prison or in local jail. Like, those are the two places that most people end up. And so having a facility that's supported by the community, the financial support for that kind of infrastructure separate from the ER is unusual. So that's at like one end of the spectrum, and something I think, you know, Amy and I have been really proud of. One of the things that we contributed to that activity, but as part of that, we also did a bunch of funding within the hospital. So if you think about the caregivers that are on the front lines of things day in, day out, especially if you map to a situation like COVID, like the challenges that they had to deal with, not just the doctors and the nurses, but the staff, is extreme. There's other programs that we funded, like at BCH, there's something called the Red Lipstick Fund, which is a fund to give resources to patients that couldn't otherwise afford them. So just lots of things that are not necessarily direct, like I'm going to go address this part of the mental health problem, but indirect, where it provides support and infrastructure in your local community. There's lots of ways to do that. Some financial, lots of resources if you're a person who likes to volunteer or spend their time, and or political in the context of local communities and where dollars get allocated in local communities, especially in a time frame where more and more hospital systems are privatized. You know, their funding is very much economic model funding versus community health type funding. Other things I've tried to do that I think have been pretty effective and have been fun to be involved in include things like grand challenges. UCLA did a grand challenge around depression with the goal of eliminating the stigma around depression and incorporating understanding of mental health and mental health issues across the entire campus, not just for students, but for all faculty members, all staff, but then woven into the research fabric in many different departments at UCLA. And one of the opportunities there, it's what you're doing with this podcast, what the two of you are doing with this podcast is, you know, just being open about people who are leaders in different parts of society or business, talking about their own struggles with the goal of destigmatizing the issues. I come back to that word because I think it's such an important one. When I was a kid, cancer had an enormous stigma associated with it. My dad was a doctor, he's an endocrinologist, but I would regularly hear about, you know, people who had cancer, and it was terrifying. And, you know, there was always like, as a little kid, should I not get close to them? What should we do? They were scary people. When they got sicker in society, it was not very caring towards a lot of people with cancer. And sort of the magic moment there was Norm Cousins in a book he wrote, which I'm going to forget the name of, where he was the first doctor to really talk about how your mental health had a huge impact on your well-being if you had cancer. It didn't necessarily, it wasn't like, and you'll be cured, but it was that the quality of your life will be dramatically impacted by your well-being and the well-being of people around you. I was in college in the 80s, and for anybody who was in college in the 80s, a switch flipped overnight around sexual activity, where, you know, as a young adult in their, you know, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, like, you know, sex is a thing, and college and sex are things. And all of a sudden there's this new disease that people are getting because they're having sex. And it's a disease that people are dying from. And then it's a disease that all of a sudden is being affiliated with the gay community. And so there's a stigma associated in the 80s still with being homosexual and whether you're openly homosexual or not. And all of those things together literally flipped a switch on the ideas around sex for a lot of people that were essentially coming of age in the mid 80s. And it was, people respond in lots of different ways to it, and, you know, from, you know, one end of the spectrum, people who are risk takers and have a risk taking psychology at that age, okay, well, that's, you're going to take different behavior than people who are very not risk taking. But same kind of thing, like if you think about all of that period of time and you fast forward to today and you think about HIV and AIDS today, it's much better understood. The stigma around homosexuality, at least in contemporary society, is largely the stigma, I would say, about having an HIV positive diagnosis is largely gone. The idea of safe sex is incorporated into society, whether people practice it, whether it's abstinence is a version of that too, like whatever it is, like the stigma in that moment for a couple of years, 2, 3, 4 years was extreme. And if I had a punchline from all of that, I think anything people who are interested in engaging around mental health, especially at a community or civic level, anything that you can do to get involved in organizations that either provide support, because most of them are underfunded and under-resourced in today's society, or organizations that lower stigma, eliminate stigma, have people have a better understanding of how this is woven into the fabric of our everyday life and why it can be an opportunity and not a burden, as long as people are willing to put some energy into it.
Well, there's a lot of ways that people can plug into and what you said, and we'll put some of those in the show notes. And I just want to add one more thing. So as many of you know, I'm working on a project in Paradise Valley, Montana, at the mouth of the north entrance to Yellowstone Park. And it's a unique property in which there's a large luxury home and then five apartments and then three other homes on this beautiful parcel of land. And I've been realizing as I've been working on this project that maybe there's a bigger reason why I'm involved with it. And I think that it would be the perfect setup for people that wanted to do retreats. I would love to work with somebody who wanted to address mental health issues or some of the other issues that I cared about that would want to leverage these properties for that. So I just share that. And Sheila, I'm realizing that we're almost to the end of our podcast, but there's a question I really wanted to ask you because it came up with all of our listeners when we called them about questions they'd like to ask, which is, where is the line between supporting and enabling? And I'm curious from your experience, have you made any mistakes there or any lessons on crossing that line?
Great question. And there is, I'm not saying it's a fine line between supporting and enabling. It's kind of a different line. It can be apples and oranges, really. And I've certainly probably, in my own experience with people who I love, try to be really vigilant in terms of the way I act with them, because I am not only am a people pleaser, I'm a helper. So it's, I want to be sure that I'm trying to do what they want. But sometimes when you go too far over that line of supporting to enabling, that's problematic. And so I've seen it in myself, and I've definitely seen it in other people who I've loved, that has caused a lot of problems when you venture into that enabling and you don't recognize it, and then you don't know how to get out of it.
Brad, any thoughts on that?
I think that's well said. I'll give two words to consider. Is the activity you're doing for the other person, or is it for you?
Yeah.
And I think that's at the essence of it. And you know, your example with the woman that was bulimic, you know, that you had the magic moment when you realized she was bulimic and that she was essentially engaging with you in a way, but that was, you know, you weren't understanding because of her own issues. She probably wasn't understanding how she was engaging with you. My guess is she was engaging with you more for her than for you in those moments. You know, you could even turn that around because she might not even be aware that she's engaging for herself, you know, in a fully conscious way. So I think the boundary line when you are engaging with somebody that you're trying to help, again, back to the comment, we all have issues. Every single human being on this planet has issues. And if somebody says, no, I'm different, I don't have issues, then we could spend a lot of time starting with where their issues are. Stepping back from it, it's like, okay, wait a second. Is this thing that I'm doing with this other person who's struggling right now, am I doing it to help and support them, or am I doing it to address something that's a need I have? Is it something that, you know, is a problem that I'm avoiding, or is it something that feeds me in a way that they actually don't need right now? And so just trying to turn it around, you know, it's not an easy answer, but supporting would be for them, enabling would be for you.
Yeah. And the last thing that I'll add to that is, for me, I don't want people to enable me, but I would like people to hear me. I like people to take their shoes off when they come into my home. I think that that's a reasonable request, regardless of whether I've had OCD or not. And there are some people that just assume that I'm only doing that because I have OCD. And they feel that it's their duty to wear shoes in my house so that I get more comfortable with people doing that. And it doesn't feel like I'm being heard when that happens. If they would ask me, what are your reasons for wanting me to take off my shoes And they decided that that was too far over the top and that they didn't want to enable that behavior, then fine. But when they assume, before even asking the question, it's hurtful.
It's also a really good example where somebody says, oh, well, I'm going to help you with your OCD by wearing shoes around your house. That's in the same category for me of somebody saying, oh, I see you're struggling. How can I help? Where the person actually didn't help. They just put another burden on me because they asked me in a moment where I was struggling what they could do to help me not struggle. And so it's this very interesting dynamic. I think it does come back to supporting versus enabling. A lot of the supporting behavior, if somebody's trying to be supportive, is to actually think pretty hard about what really will be helpful for the other person, rather than assuming that your behavior is going to solve whatever their problem is. It probably won't have any impact on it that's positive, and it might have only a negative impact.
And it comes down to just listening to the other person. Yeah. Like, that's the first step. Like, tell me what you're feeling and how I can help you, as opposed to just coming in and saying, I think that this is the best way to help you.
I'll give a parting example that's maybe an upbeat thing. When I had this depressive episode in my late 40s, a lot of people didn't know how to help. I was very public about what was going on, but you know, the people offering to help or trying to help in ways that weren't helpful, most of those didn't really bother me that much. On the positive side, there were a few people who were profoundly helpful, Amy being one of them, but also my first business partner, Dave, who knew me for a very long time. And he and I had talked about this stuff over the years as he, you know, figured out some of his own stuff. And one of the things he knew was that I loved going for a walk during the day, and he loved going for walks and hikes. But instead of like going through this, okay, let's go for a walk every Tuesday at 3 o'clock because I want to check in on you and see how you're doing, he would call, coordinate with my assistant, probably email with my assistant, find out when I had an open hour in my calendar, he'd grab it, you know, a couple of days in the future, because he was sort of doing it on short term. And he'd just show up at my office. And a lot of times I wouldn't even notice that it was the next meeting. He'd show up and he'd be like, hey, let's go for a walk. And I'd look at the calendar and I'd say, oh, I don't have anything for the next hour. My assistant was blocking the hour, but she wasn't saying, you know, walk with Dave. I'd say, oh, cool, I got an hour. Let's go for a walk. And we go for a walk and he wouldn't say, how are you doing? How's it going? Are you feeling any better? What can I do to help? You know, tell me what's going on. We just walk. And sometimes we'd walk for an hour, 45 minutes or an hour, not really say much, just kind of walk as friends. And sometimes something would just kind of pour out of me and I'd start talking about something and we'd follow that thread. And sometimes it had to do with whatever was going on with me. And sometimes it was something totally different. He was just there. And part of that was he knew that when I was struggling, what was really helpful to me was having someone who cared a lot about me just be there.
Mm. So to close this out and put these thoughts into practice, Brad, I'm really feeling like I'd like to help you promote this book. And I'm not saying that because I want to just help you, which I do, but I feel like the principles that you have in that book have the power to create the kind of ripple effect that I want to see in the world. And I've been thinking through this call about the best way for me to continue to help push that ripple effect. And I'm wondering if it would be helpful for me to write a blog post about the ways in which Give First has helped me in my career and also helped me make a bigger impact in the world. Is that a way that might help you, or could you think of something else that I could do to be more helpful?
Yeah, I think things like that are incredibly helpful. And I put it in the category, which I've, my throwaway line to the world now is, if you like the book, make some music about it. I said, make some noise to someone. They said, noise is discordant. You don't want noise, you want music. So I like the idea of music. So blog post is music, you know, reviews on all the social media, you know, Amazon, Goodreads, whatever. you know, that kind of stuff is super additive, but not, hey, not book reports. Hey, Brad's book is good. Here's a book report. The things that are really interesting is incorporating it into your life and telling from your life experience. There've been, you know, a number of people that I know that have read the book have already written these stories, you know, 1,000 word, 2,000 word essays, whatever, of here's how this impacted me. Here's how this philosophy of give first, here's how mentorship impacted me. Not here's the thing Brad did for me that was good. You know, I'm talking about myself in third person, but more here's what these concepts did and how they positively impacted my life. That's hugely helpful.
Mm. Great. Thank you. Well, Sheila, do you want to close us out?
I have really enjoyed this conversation. I've actually learned a lot. Going back to close to the beginning when, Brad, when you talked about OCD and you said linking the O and then the C, that was like a light bulb going off over my head. I got to think about that one a lot. You know, one of them is the O and one of them is the C. So I guess on that note, Brad, thanks for joining us. And Elizabeth, as always, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. And I hope everybody who listens learns as much as I have.
Well, thank you for having me. And Elizabeth, thank you for being so open about all of this stuff and engaging with me around it.
Thank you. All right, okay. Until next time.
The Imperfectly Honest podcast is for informational, educational, and entertainment purposes only. This podcast does not provide medical advice and is not intended as a substitute for the diagnosis and treatment provided by a licensed, trained physician, psychotherapist, or other health professional. Note that, notwithstanding that any of the guests on this podcast may be licensed professionals, no one on this podcast is providing or seeking to provide the listeners of this podcast with any medical or health services. You should not rely on the information or content presented during this podcast, and you should not make any health or medical-related decision based in whole or in part on such information. Consult a healthcare professional licensed in your state for all matters relating to your health, and do not disregard any medical advice, diagnosis, and/or treatment provided by your healthcare professional. This podcast expresses the individual opinions of Elizabeth, Sheila, and their guests, and does not constitute professional medical or mental health services. In sharing their experiences, names, places, and other identifying information may be changed to protect the privacy of the people involved.